Indiana, and the
director or co-director of the Schrodinger Institute. And today you'll speak to us on something that has Mahler measure in the title, so I mean, what else do you have to say?
Well, it's a great pleasure to be back in Vancouver with weather like this. I had a wonderful walk this morning down to the beach, and then I remembered that actually I have to do some other things here as well, so I had to come back. So the full title is Mahler Measure, Factors of Markov Shifts and Symbolic Representations of Group Automorphisms. I won't write that down. But it started with a talk which Wershig gave. At least for me, it started with that talk in Warwick in 94. The papers he was referring to were a couple of years earlier, and he was looking at the following problem. You take the beta transformation, you take a real number beta greater than 1, and you define a map T beta from the unit interval to itself, which is T beta of x is equal to beta x mod 1. And let's write it as beta of x minus eta of x. So this is just the integer part of beta x. Then the beta expansion of a number x in the unit interval is the sequence eta of x, eta of t beta x, and so on. It's a sequence of integers, all of which are non-negative and all of which are less than beta. Now, for certain betas, he looked at the case where beta squared is equal to beta plus 1. So this means that beta is equal to 1 plus square root of 5 over 2. At least I hope it is. The set of all these expansions is very easily described. It's the set of all sequences, so the set of all such expansions is called the beta shift. And it's the set of all, in this particular case, it's the set of all, let's call it x beta, it's the set of all sequences in the digits 0 and 1, one-sided sequences, with the property that you never have two ones in a row. Everything else is allowed. So something like 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1 would be legal, but if you had a 1, 1 somewhere, then that would be forbidden. So this, of course, is a set of one-sided sequences because this expansion starts with a given beta and you get this sequence of integers which has a beginning. But you can look at the two-sided shift which just obeys the same rule. It's a set of two-sided sequences of zeros and ones which never have two ones in a row. So we have the two-sided beta shift. Let's call that V beta. It's just, as I said, the obvious extension which makes this two-sided. In other words, it's the set of all two-sided sequences of zeros and ones which have the property that whenever you draw a line somewhere, what you see to the right of this line follows this rule. So this is a subset in 0, 1 to the Z. Same rules. And what Wershig explained in that talk, well, maybe I should say stated in that talk, is that this two-sided beta shift has a nice map from two, the two-dimensional torus, t squared, r squared mod z squared, with the property that it sends the shift sigma, that's the shift, or let's be precise, the left shift on v beta to the toral automorphism 1, 1, 1, 0. So in other words, the two-sided beta shift is, and this is almost a definition now, is a symbolic representation, symbolic because it's a sequence space, on a sequence space, of this toral automorphism 1, 1, 1, 0. And he wrote down the map. I have tried to reproduce it. Every time I do this calculation, I end up with a different expression. But I think the same thing happened to Wershig. So if you have a sequence Vn, which lies in V beta, you send it, well, you have to write down two numbers between 0 and 1 in order to describe a point here. And the two numbers are minus 1 over root 5. Oh, maybe I should say this beta, let's call this beta plus, that's the large root. And then there is a small root, which is 1 minus square root of 5 over 2. So it is, unless I'm mistaken, V naught beta plus inverse plus V1 beta plus to the minus 2 plus and so on plus, oops, the minus 1, 1 over root 5 stays there, V minus 1 plus V minus 2 beta minus plus V minus 3 beta minus squared and so on. So all this converges nicely because here you take negative powers of the large root and positive powers of the small root, and that's the first coordinate of this map. And the second coordinate is almost the same, it's just shifted a little. It's plus square 1 over square root of 5 times V naught plus V1 beta inverse plus and so on plus V minus 1 beta minus plus V minus 2 beta minus squared plus and so on. So this expression baffled me and it baffled some other people, and we couldn't really understand exactly how it worked. Wershig was saying that this was not an accident restricted to this particular beta. He said it was general. And indeed, in a later paper, but I'm now anticipating history a little bit, Sidorov and Wershig extended this, or an analog of this formula, to all hyperbolic automorphisms of the two torus. So then, well, it puzzled me, and it was one of those things I wanted to understand and then forgot all about it. But then I came to Seattle, I think it was in 97, and started working with Doug Lind on homoclinic points of hyperbolic toral automorphisms. So you take T to the N. We'll have to generalize this in a moment, but let's stick to this simple setting right now. You have an automorphism alpha, which we assume, so this any such automorphism is linear, so it's given by an N by N matrix with real entries, and we are assuming that none of the eigenvalues has absolute value 1. So there are some which are large and some which are small, and none which are kind of neutral. Then there exist points, Homo Clinic points. Before I define Homo Clinic points, I should point out that hyperbolicity means that if you have a point in the torus, in t to the n, which is non-zero, at some stage it has to get far away from zero. It has to get away from zero by some specified amount. The reason is that locally around zero, this map alpha is hyperbolic, so there's going to be some direction or some set of directions in which it's going to expand and another set of directions in which it's going to contract. So if you have a point which in this coordinate system has a non-zero coordinate in this direction, then it's going to move away from zero in positive time. If it has zero coordinate in this direction, then it's going to move away from zero in negative time, because then this direction will be expanding. So if you then, of course, if it gets away far enough, it's going to wrap around because you take everything mod z to the n, but it has to get away from zero by some specified amount. So there are no points. There exists an expansive constant. Which means that the infimum, well, let's call it delta, for all non-zero x, the distance between alpha to the n x and zero is going to be greater than delta for some n. This is a little elliptic. All I'm trying to say is that somewhere along the orbit, you're going to be away from zero by some specified amount, which is independent of the point x you're looking at. But there are homoclinic points. There exists points, y, say, such that the limit as n tends to infinity, either in the positive or the negative direction of alpha to the n, y, is equal to zero. So there are points which go to zero in the future and in the past, but somewhere in between, of course, they have to get away from zero by some amount, namely at least by delta. So we were looking at these homoclinic points for toral automorphisms, for expansive toral automorphisms, and more generally for commuting group automorphisms. If you have several commuting group automorphisms, say D commuting group automorphisms, you have a ZD action on the group, and then you would call a point homoclinic if it tends to zero as you move to infinity in ZD in any direction. So, in other words, going to infinity in the sense that you leave any finite subset, then this point, the orbit of this point, would be close to zero most of the time, except for finitely many exceptions. Okay, so let's look at a very special case. This is just to establish a connection with Wershig's construction and example in particular. Let's define automorphisms of t to the n, or more general, of some more general compact connected abelian groups, in a particular way. Let's take a polynomial f in a single variable, but we allow a Laurent polynomial, so we can have negative powers. But there are only finitely many non-zero coefficients. And let's define from this polynomial f an automorphism of a compact abelian group. And we define X, it's a subgroup of T to the Z, and it's the set of all sequences xn, let's give this polynomial, let's make this polynomial a little more explicit. You'll see in a moment that we may actually assume that f is a polynomial in the sense that there are no negative powers in f. And let's assume that this is f naught plus and so on plus fm u to the m, where the first and last term are non-zero. And here we look at the set of all sequences which have the property that for all n, xn times f naught plus and so on plus fm times x n plus m is equal to 0 mod 1. So this is a closed shift invariant subset and in fact subgroup of t to the z. It's like a linear recurrence relation except that we do it mod 1. Let's take as an example the polynomial f equal to u squared minus u minus 1. So this means that xn plus 2 is always equal to xn plus 1 for all n, just repeating this definition here. Then you can see that this is for all x in x. Maybe I should make this dependence explicit, xf here. Yeah? So for all x, you have this relation. So if you have a point x and you know the zero and the first coordinate of x, you can calculate all the other coordinates. You can calculate x2, then you can calculate x3 and so on. Similarly, you can calculate x minus 1. So if we take such a point x and we send it to the point x1, x0, then this is a bijection between this group xf for this particular polynomial and the two torus. If we shift the point sigma x, then what do we get here? We get x1, x2. The point shifts to the left, so the zero coordinate of the shifted point is the first coordinate of the original point, and then we have the second coordinate, which is now in the place of the original first coordinate. So if we move x by sigma, we have this diagram. But what is x2? It's x0 plus x1, that's the rule here, x1. So this is equal to 1, 0 applied to x1, x0. In other words, the shift here corresponds to this automorphism which we have just been discussing, 1, 1, 1, 0. We've just written this toral automorphism in a peculiar way. So let's check what is this group here, xf. I mean, here we can see it fairly explicitly. I mean, we can, for example, look down here. But this space of sequences, which we have defined here for a general polynomial, is maybe not quite so easy to understand. Think, for example, of the polynomial. This is just to confuse the issue. Take another polynomial, which is 2u minus 3. So this means that wherever you look, if you take that coordinate 3 times, it's the same, modulo 1, as taking twice the coordinate to the right of it. So what this means is that every coordinate x of x gets multiplied by 3 over 2. So it's multiplication by 3 over 2 on the circle. Okay? That's how you make this into a group automorphism. So here we have our group XF. This sits inside T to the Z. Now what's making things complicated is that we are reducing everything mod 1. We have this linear recurrence relation, which holds modulo integers. So let's do the following. Let us lift the coordinates in a bounded way to elements of L infinity of ZR. Bounded sequences, let's make a little more space here, XF. So we lift each coordinate. This XF consists of sequences of real numbers, mod 1. And we just lift each coordinate to a real number correctly, so that mod 1 you get what you started off with, and that the resulting sequence is bounded. Let's call that WF. Then we have here a map going down, which is just mod 1 in each coordinate. So here we have the set of all sequences of real numbers, which have the property that if you reduce them mod 1, you get something in here. How do you recognize these sequences? Well, they are those sequences which, when you take, I'll write down a more general expression in a moment, up here, Wn, that's a lift of Xn. Wn plus 1 was a lift of Xn plus 1. And these two together, here, mod 1, were equal to Xn plus 2. So Wn plus 2 has to be equal to the sum of these two modulo an integer. So if we take here the map f of sigma, so this is sigma squared minus sigma minus 1 for this particular polynomial, we end up with a sequence of integers, a bounded sequence of integers. Okay? It's just a definition. The elements of WF are precisely those elements of L infinity ZR, the bounded two-sided real sequences, which when you apply this expression to them, become sequences of integers, necessarily bounded sequences of integers. Bear with me, this really has something to do with Verschig's construction.
Could you repeat what that map is? Could you repeat, what is that map?
Yeah. Our polynomial f is u squared minus u minus 1. Mm-hmm. Now I substitute for u, for the variable u, the shift. So sigma squared means shift the sequence two steps to the left. In other words, you now see at the zero place the second coordinate of the sequence, and you subtract from it the first and the zeroth coordinate, and then you end up with an integer. That was the rule. Well, something amazing happens to be true here. This map is a bijection. And the reason why it's a bijection is the existence of a very special homoclinic point. So let me try and explain that thing. And it'll turn out that what it says, what stands here, are precisely coordinates of this special homoclinic point. So how do you see that this map is a bijection? So this map from this is a bijection. Suppose we can prove that there is an element of F double of WF which gets sent to a point in L infinity ZZ which has a single one at the zero coordinate and everything else is zero. Then we are done. So suppose that there exists, I'll write it down as a statement, in fact, which happens to be true. There exists a W delta in L infinity of ZR such that if you apply F of sigma to it, you get let's call that V delta, and Vn delta is equal to 0 if n is non-zero and 1 if n is equal to 0. That's the kind of the unit vector at the zero coordinate. And you can calculate this point explicitly. It's not the most recommended way of doing this abstractly, but if f is hyperbolic, then W n delta, I'm writing down the nth coordinate of this mysterious point here, is equal to 1 over Fm. This is the representation of F which we have up here. It's the highest term. Times sum B omega. These are the small roots. So the roots of absolute value less than 1. Remember, F is supposed to be hyperbolic, so there are no roots of absolute value equal to 1. B omega times omega to the n minus 1. This is for n greater than or equal to 1. And otherwise, it's the sum of minus b omega. I haven't told you what b omega is. Omega to the n minus 1. This is if n is less than or equal to 0. And here we have the large roots. Oops, can't write down here. So for large roots, here we have negative powers. So this is, again, an exponentially decreasing sequence. We just split the roots into two parts, those which contract, those which expand. And then we write down this point, which has the property that both sides decrease exponentially. Then this point, if you get bored, I haven't told you what the B omega are. We have 1 divided by F of U is equal to 1 over Fm sum. Maybe we should assume that it's also irreducible. So in particular, we don't have any double roots. 1 over Fm sum B omega divided by U minus omega. It's just partial fraction expansion of F. These are the coefficients which you see there. So if you get bored with the rest of the talk, you can just do this calculation. So this point has, let me repeat this because that's important, it has the nice property that it decays exponentially on both sides, and it has the property that F of sigma W delta, that's the calculation which you can do, is indeed equal to this point V delta, which we wanted. That's this point here. So suppose we have found and identified this point, and suppose what I said is true, then we can define the inverse of this map F sigma up here. So this is F of sigma inverse of V. So associated with each bounded sequence of integers, Vn, I should be able to give you a point in Wf which gets sent back to V, and the point is equal to the sum of Vn sigma to the minus n W delta over n and z. And this sum converges in each coordinate because as you move this point, the coordinates decay exponentially. So if you are interested, let's say, in the zero coordinate of this sum, there you will see V0 times the point plus V1 times its minus first coordinate plus V2 times its minus second coordinate and so on plus V minus 1 times its first coordinate and so on. And this is all summable. Well, this is then immediate if you believe. This is immediate. That this is really the inverse map is immediate from this one. Okay, so we have found a map from L infinity ZZ to WF, which we can then compose with this map mod 1 to get down here. So we've got a map from this space of sequences to our toral automorphism. Of course, this is a huge space, and this is nice and compact, so this map is highly redundant. But what exactly is the redundancy of this map? When is a sequence here going to be sent to zero down here? Well, it's going to go to zero precisely if when you send it over here you only see integers. Because this map reduces you mod 1 and you get something zero if every coordinate already was an integer. So the kernel, let's give this map a name, Xi. So the kernel of Xi is equal to those sequences which, when you bring them over here, are integer sequences. In other words, it's the same as f of sigma of the integer sequences here. So this is equal to f of sigma applied to L infinity of ZZ sitting inside L infinity of ZZ. So it's those two-sided sequences, which this is one way to think about it. You could look at each of these two-sided sequences formally as a two-sided power series. Then there are those power series, those bounded power series, which are multiples, actually not of F because of some notational quirk, but of F of U inverse, F with the variable inverted. This space here, L infinity ZZ, as I said, is much too big. It contains, say, the full shift on any finite alphabet. So, for example, you could choose your coordinates to be from 0 to capital N minus 1. Then in here you have all sequences whose coordinates are always between 0 and N minus 1. So you have the full N shift here, which has, for those who have heard these words before, entropy log N. But the entropy of this toral automorphism is finite, and therefore if n is large enough, then the entropy of this bounded piece of L infinity ZZ will be much too big. So you would like to find subsets of this space on which this map Xi, which we've defined there, is as injective as possible. There should be little redundancy so that you don't get all these points which are not really contributing anything anymore to the original space XF. Well, it turns out that for the F we started off with, so this was for general F, let's return to F equal to U squared minus U minus 1. For this particular F, the two-sided beta shift, which sits in here, is precisely one of those sets on which the map Xi is almost injective. It cannot be injective. It cannot be injective on a closed shift invariant subset here, injective and surjective at the same time, because this closed shift invariant subset would be zero dimensional, but this space is connected. So even if you find a nice set here which is mapped onto XF in an almost one-to-one way, there has to be some redundancy. Otherwise, the topology doesn't work out. So and this is what, in fact, Bershik calculated. The restriction of Xi, and Xi is precisely the map which I had defined somewhat abstractly here, to V beta, this is for this polynomial F now, is surjective and almost one-to-one. Almost one-to-one means that the set where it's bijective is a dense G delta, which in this case carries every shift invariant probability measure of full support. Every ergodic shift invariant measure of full support. I should be careful, there are people who understand. Okay, Brian has nodded, so I'm safe. Then the question arose, this was in the paper by Sidorov and Wershik. They did this for degree 2 maps, and they could prove, I think in that paper they proved that for any polynomial f of degree 2, which gives an algebraic unit, so the initial coefficient is 1 and the final coefficient, the constant, is plus or minus 1, all this works well. But the general question, there are two questions. What is a good choice, or what is a good analog of this space V beta? In other words, what is a good closed shift invariant subset, which you can describe reasonably well, such that this map Xi restricted to the subset is almost one-to-one and surjective? Well, one can show they exist. One can show that if beta is a Piesel number, so this is an algebraic integer, which is greater than 1, but all its conjugates are less than 1 in modulus, that the space V beta is a candidate. It's a candidate in the following sense. One can actually show that the map from that V beta, so for Piesel beta, Xi restricted to V beta is surjective and bounded to 1. But it's not known whether it is always almost one-to-one. That's still open. So it's not known if almost one-to-one. This is what you can do for Piesel beta. For other hyperbolic polynomials, there are no good candidates. Here's one possible candidate, except nobody knows how to, as far as I know at this stage, nobody knows how to check it. You could, for example, take the beta here and replace this beta by the product of the large eigenvalues of A, large roots of F. then the entropy would work all right. That would be a space. It would be a closed shift invariant subset. It would not be as simple in nature as the one we have been looking at here, but it's something which might work, except that there's no proof. Let me come to... Let me come to a question which is very closely related to what we are doing here. This space V beta is almost, it's not quite, but it's almost L infinity of ZZ modulo F of sigma of L infinity of ZZ. Remember, this was the kernel of the map Xi, so we take the domain of Xi, you mod out by the kernel, and you want to know how big this space is. So you take all two-sided, if you want to express it that way, all two-sided formal bounded power series with integer coefficients. You call two of them equivalent if they differ by something in here, which is, if you like, a multiple of F of sigma, and you want to know how big this space is. Well, apart from clarifying a few minor points in this question, we know exactly how big this space is. It's XF. So we know, for example, the entropy of this space. And the entropy of this space is the sum of the logarithms of the absolute values of the large roots of F. So we can say, in some sense precisely, how big this space is. So the entropy is equal to the sum of the log plus of the omega, which are the roots of F, F of omega equal to zero. Log plus means you take the absolute value of omega, and if this is less than one, you write zero. If the absolute value is greater than one, you take the usual logarithm. Which, there was a conference in Banff very recently, which I missed due to unusual but regular weather phenomena, I believe is the correct description. It's the logarithmic Mahler measure of F. So it's log M of F. I'm not even going to define it because there was this conference in Banff which told everybody all about Mahler measures. So you see this number coming up as this, as something associated with this peculiar quotient space. Now I notice that time is moving steadily forward. So there were two other main themes which I wanted to themes which I wanted to explore. The first one is what happens if F has roots of absolute value 1. We are still assuming that F is irreducible, so there's one trivial case where F is actually cyclotomic, so there are roots of unity, which are roots of F, so F is something like, I don't know, U minus 1, say. Yeah, that's a nice, simple example. Or U squared plus U plus 1, something like this. That's not interesting. The Mahler measure of those polynomials is 0 in any case, or the logarithmic Mahler measure is 0. But if F is more interesting, like U to the 4 minus U to the 3 minus U squared minus U plus 1, this would be a nice irreducible polynomial, which is not cyclotomic, and has two roots of absolute value 1, and it's close to David's and my heart. So this is a so-called Salem number. It's an algebraic integer, or even unit, which is greater than 1, and has two conjugates on the unit circle. Then you can also define a toral automorphism, which is just the companion matrix of this polynomial, and you can try to do the same thing. So you can look at the toral automorphism 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, and then we have, I believe, minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So this has, this matrix has this as its eigen polynomial, characteristic polynomial. You can look at this toral automorphism and you can ask, is there anything similar you can do there? Well, one of the key ingredients of what I was using here were homoclinic points. So the first question is, are there homoclinic points for this toral automorphism? And the answer is no. So it's not difficult to check that under this map, the only point which in the future and in the past converges to zero is actually zero itself. Let me make a trivial observation, a trivial corollary of this statement, which I have not seen in the literature, but surely somebody must have seen it before. It shows that there can never be any nice symbolic representation of this space. Suppose you had a shift of finite type, which is usually what is regarded as a nice symbolic representation, mapped to the four torus in an equivariant way. So if you shift the sequences, then on the four torus it would correspond to applying this matrix. On the shift of finite type, you have plenty of homoclinic sequences which share the remote past and the remote future. If you had two such points, they would be sent to two points on the four torus, which are homoclinic. So the difference in the definition I gave would be homoclinic to zero, homoclinic in the sense I gave. But there are no such points, so any two such points would be identified. But for the homoclinic equivalence class in any shift of finite type, in any mixing shift of finite type, is actually dense. So this means that the whole space would have to be sent to a single point. No Markov partitions. Okay, so this certainly doesn't work. Now, you could think, well, maybe one can find a map which is just not continuous, which would therefore mess up homoclinic properties. If you had a nice sequence space which gets sent to the four torus in a Borel way, then you could transport all the invariant measures on the sequence space to invariant measures on the four torus. So you would get lots and lots of invariant measures on the four torus. Now there is a recent result due to Elon Lindenstrauss and myself that any ergodic invariant measure on the four torus has a very peculiar, other than Lebesgue measure is one of them, has a very peculiar property. So here's your four torus, somewhat simplified. This matrix is linear, locally at least, so it'll have one expanding eigenspace, one contracting eigenspace, and then it'll have a two-dimensional leaf in which it's a rotation, because there the eigenvalues are of absolute value 1. This leaf wraps around densely. So you have in these four torus a dense foliation by cosets of R2, of R squared, on which this matrix acts as a rotation. Of course, on the whole foliation, it acts in a more complicated way. It takes such a leaf, moves it to another leaf, and rotates it in the process. So that's what this matrix does to each of these leaves. Then, this measure mu has the property, if it's ergodic, that it sits on a Borel set, which intersects each leaf of this foliation in a circle. This circle could be reduced to a single point. So this measure, in fact, if you know what the word means, if you assume that the measure is weakly mixing, then this intersection has to be a single point. So it would have to be sitting on a Borel set, which intersects each leaf of this foliation in at most one point. Now, this foliation is dense, so there are no decent cross-sections. It's not a nice object, this quotient space. But nevertheless, the measure decides to sit on one of these very nice cross-sections of this space. So this shows that measures which are invariant under this toral automorphism are very restricted in a way. They must see only a very small amount of the space, because if they, this is now meta-mathematics, if they saw a large amount of the space, you couldn't foliate it nicely by this leaf, by these leaves. So there are very severe restrictions on invariant measures, which, by the argument I gave earlier, give you very severe restrictions on any possible symbolic covers of the space. It is possible to define a map psi, which is analogous to what we've done here. It sits on it does sit again on L infinity ZZ, but it is not equivariant. It has the property that if you shift the point in this space and look at its image, it's not the image with the toral automorphism applied to it, but you apply the toral automorphism and then you translate it along the central leaf. So it's a more complicated map. But one can describe it, one can deal with it to some extent. And you can then again ask, are there any economical covers? And without wanting to go into details, I would just like to state that you get to exactly the same question. You have L infinity ZZ modulo F of sigma L infinity ZZ for a polynomial which is now not hyperbolic. So I have 3 minutes. I can point to a result by Brian Marcus, Carl Peterson, and Susan Williams. Which has something to do with this. So this means I'll have covered two of the four topics which I wanted to cover. This space is horrible, because L infinity is a difficult space. You could restrict yourself to some bounded subset of L infinity, in which case the space becomes a little nicer. But let's be more modest. Let's just take a bounded subset, for example, if you like, 0 to n minus 1 to the z sitting inside L infinity of z, z. And we define an equivalence relation. V is equivalent to V prime. These are 2 points in here. If V n is not equal to Vn prime for only finitely many n in Z, so they differ in only finitely many coordinates, and V minus V prime, so this is now a point with only finitely many non-zero coordinates. So if you wanted to, you could write it as a Laurent polynomial. Just put the variable with the correct power in each place. And then we want this. So and this is equal to F of sigma times something, times H for some H in Z of u plus minus 1, some honest polynomial. So you could look at this slightly nicer equivalence relation, and then it turns out, due to a result by Marcus, Peterson, and Williams, that if you look at the space of equivalence classes you get in this way, that's a Sophic shift. This is the result about restriction of shifts of factor maps of shifts of finite type to spaces on which they are, to Sophic shifts on which they are then finite to one. But if this is, so this works, in other words, we have always this space V beta which we had here, you can always find some analog which is nice from a symbolic point of view. If f is not hyperbolic, then this is no longer possible. You will typically get not a factor of a shift of finite type, but a factor of a shift of finite type with infinite state space. So this is, again, a significant difference between the hyperbolic and the non-hyperbolic case, but the entropy of this quotient space is still given by this formula. So I'll stop now. What I would have said if I had another hour or so is there is a multivariate analog where you replace the first z by z to the d, then again everything works fine in the expansive case, which means in this case that the variety of the polynomial does not has no points which have all coordinates of absolute value 1. So there you have essentially the same picture, except that this quotient space becomes much more complicated. And then there is the non-expansive case there, where the variety can intersect the polydisk, and then nothing is known anymore. But the conjecture is that in all these cases, the entropy of this quotient space would be the logarithmic Mahler measure of the polynomial f. Thank you. I think this... This is, I think I've been following the general rule that towards the end of a talk, of any good talk, nobody should be able to follow things anymore. So that part of it, at least, I've done right.
Even somebody who wrote a paper that you see?
Yes.
Who should be asking questions? So aren't there any questions for this?
Yeah, if beta is hyperbolic, you can define V beta.
If beta is hyperbolic, then this has the entropy is too low, because this is if beta is p, so then that's fine, because then beta is the only large root. All the other roots are of absolute value less than 1.
So you're saying that you can find v sub beta.
You can find an analog of v sub beta. There is a sophic shift sitting inside L infinity zz, such that this map is almost 1-to-1. But it's not canonical, and it certainly doesn't have any sensible, nice definition. There is no nice candidate. It would be nice to look at the polynomial f, to get a number from that, and or whatever, some construction of a nice shift directly from the polynomial.
The beta. The
analog of that number beta. Well, the analog would have to be the product of the large root set.
That's what Fizeau means. There's one root outside?
Yes, yes.
So that's the problem. You could have two roots.
Yes, that's right.
You don't know
what the right space would be. You know what entropy it has to have, and the candidate which I was suggesting does have the right entropy, but it's not at all clear what the connection between this shift is and anything else I've said.
Well, if you take that product, it will have also other conjugates outside.
The product of the large roots, the minimal polynomial of that is something complicated. So it does not fit in well with the original polynomial f. As a general principle, there are nice homoclinic points, and therefore one can do something like this if you have expansiveness. If you have no expansiveness, even for a single automorphism, there are no homoclinic points. If you have several commuting maps, then sometimes you have no homoclinic points, sometimes you have nice homoclinic points, you can still do the same thing. Sometimes you have too many homoclinic points, then you don't know what to do again. So it's strange that all the information which one can at this stage safely obtain about this quotient space goes via this very circuitous route of identifying this quotient space with some action on a compact connected abelian group by commuting group automorphisms, calculating the entropy of that, and then concluding trivially that that must have been the entropy of this space. One should be able to do it directly. And I think that for a single variable, there is actually a chance of doing it. But in general, it's like trying to formulate this result by Marcus, Peterson, and Williams. It's about factor maps of shifts of finite type without having a space onto which to map. So you have some sort of equivalence relation up here, but there is no nice space of equivalence classes to which you can map. So you have to find some sort of substitute for that, and without that, this proof is certainly going to be much more difficult. I think it's possible to do it, but it's not going to be very elegant, I think.
So you can't prove in some abstract way that you do have a connected compact abelian group of some sort.
There is no map in general, or at least all the maps I know of use homoclinic points, so at least some substitute for them, and even these substitutes may be missing in general.
Without a map, just somehow putting the correct topology on your funny space here.
I wish I knew how to do that. That's a very good idea.
Well, thanks again. We are having